Welcome to Ovarian Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Beth Carlin, and to obtain a feel on how she's integrating ongoing clinical research into practice, I asked her to discuss a couple of patients from her practice, and she began with a younger woman presenting with an abdominal mass and ascites.
This is a 42-year-old woman who presented to her gynecologist complaining of pelvic pressure and some bloating, and on examination indeed had a 12-centimeter mass that could be palpated as well as a fluid wave. She initially had an ultrasound demonstrating a very complex mass in the pelvis, measuring approximately 12 centimeters on one side, about 5 centimeters on the other, with the free fluid noted. A preoperative CA-125 was obtained at that time and was equal to about 1,200. I then saw the patient and discussed with her the high likelihood of a diagnosis of an ovarian carcinoma. And in light of her young age and the tumor that really appeared on imaging and on examination to be able to be surgically removed, we proceeded to the operating suite. At that time, we did see a gross tumor involving the omentum and tumor nodules on peritoneal surfaces. However, we were able to perform an optimal primary cytoreductive surgery, really down to no residual to microscopic only disease, having, of course, done the hysterectomy, bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy, omentectomy, and then tumor debulking. This patient did not require any bowel resection.
She had implants in the peritoneum?
That's correct. And in the omentum. So she would have been a stage 3C. Her pathology was a high-grade pap serous ovarian carcinoma.
Just out of curiosity, how long did the surgery take?
About 3 hours.
And what about BRCA testing?
The current NCCN guidelines do recommend that all women with high-grade epithelial ovarian cancers be offered BRCA testing. But I think it's especially true for these women in their 40s. Independent of family history, in the Australian population-based study, over 40% of the patients who ultimately were found to have BRCA mutations had no family history of breast or ovarian cancer, were not of Ashkenazi Jewish descent. So I think in these women who have high-grade serous lesions, almost independent of age, but especially in these women in their 40s, offering BRCA testing will offer them some very important information. It has been shown in multiple studies that those women with ovarian cancer and carrying a germline BRCA mutation actually have a higher likelihood of platinum sensitivity and a longer overall survival. It also may allow them to be eligible for olaparib or other PARP inhibitor trials and other agents that will be coming down the pike. Furthermore, the patients often have other family members who would benefit from knowing that they too may be at risk and would at least consider further genetic counseling and testing. I've had a number of patients where the daughter was the index case, having the BRCA testing, and then indeed only months later, the mom presents often with ovarian cancer herself in her 60s, only going in to have examinations based on the daughter's diagnosis. BRCA-associated ovarian cancers can occur at any age, but it should be brought to mind in these younger patients with high-grade serous tumors.
So we could probably spend an hour talking about the decision that you and she faced after surgery. Maybe you can just sort of boil it down to what the options were. I don't know if there were any trials she might have been eligible for you were participating in and what happened.
So she's in a group that has a high likelihood of a long progression-free interval in light of her optimal surgery, her BRCA status. But I think there was recently a meeting of the gynecologic cancer intergroup, really all the cooperative trial groups, and really boils it down to four options for a patient in this situation. The standard of 6 cycles of intravenous paclitaxel and carboplatin with an AUC of 5 or 6, given every 3 weeks, is one option. Drawing on the Japanese GOG data presented at ASCO last year, using dose-dense paclitaxel weekly with the carboplatin is another option. A third option would be the use of intraperitoneal chemotherapy, still something that should be considered, especially in these young patients, using intraperitoneal platinum in week one with IV paclitaxel and then IP paclitaxel at day eight. And that too would be an option. And I guess the fourth option would be, of course, enrolling in clinical trials. There are a number of trials available at the current time looking at patients with optimal cytoreduction, really combining chemotherapies with a targeted agent. There are trials looking at platinums and taxanes with bevacizumab in this setting, as well as other targeted agents. We have been participating in a trial looking at an antibody to the IGF, insulin-like growth factor receptor, which seems to have a mitogenic role in ovarian cancer, really driving the tumor, and looking at the use of a molecule called AMG-479 in combination with carbo and paclitaxel in the primary setting.
This is a IGF-type drug?
That's correct.
Hmm.
It was presented last year at ASCO with some fanfare for its usefulness in pancreatic cancer, and we had completed phase 2 data as a single agent in patients with recurrent ovarian cancer and saw some signal there. And we have an ongoing clinical trial in the upfront setting in patients with optimal cytoreduction looking at carbopaclitaxel plus or minus this IGF-R1 antibody. And again, we're still awaiting analysis of those data, but that trial would have also been offered to a patient like this.
Another paper that was presented at ASCO last year that I heard a lot of investigators comment on was your paper looking at the interesting molecule AMG-386.
So AMG-386 also acts in the angiogenesis pathway. In fact, it inhibits angiopoietins, which are molecules that act sort of downstream from bevacizumab and causing the branching of the vessels within the tumor. So similar to bevacizumab, it inhibits tumor angiogenesis. And what we saw in those data, again, was an improvement in progression-free survival in a group of heavily pretreated patients who received the AMG-386. Importantly, the toxicity profile was very different than that seen with bevacizumab. There wasn't any of the hypertension, no bowel perforations, or any type of thrombotic complications associated with the AMG-386 molecule. One did see some peripheral edema and often hypokalemia associated with the agent, perhaps due to the fact that patients were given a diuretic when they had peripheral edema and developed the hypokalemia, but those were the most significant complications that were seen. In that trial, it was combined with weekly paclitaxel, was a very well-tolerated regimen, and did meet its primary endpoint of an improvement in progression-free survival, and we did not have enough events to look at overall survival. On the basis of that trial, it has been moved into additional trials looking at, again, in combination with paclitaxel as well as with other agents in the recurrent and also now in the upfront setting. It's an agent that I think, again, will add to our armamentarium of moving targeted therapy to ovarian cancer, going beyond a one-size-fits-all approach. And I think even with bevacizumab, with olaparib, with AMG-386, trying to find some biomarker that allows us to choose the best regimen for each patient and really fulfilling what we want from personalized medicine, which, of course, the right medicine for the right patient at the right time. And I think that you'll be hearing more about AMG-386 in ASCOs to come.
Can you talk a little bit more about what it is? I remember thinking, what is it? It's like some kind of fused protein. Am I thinking about the right thing?
Yeah. AMG-386 is a first-in-class molecule called a peptibody. It's an angiopoietin. So it binds the Thai 1 and 2 molecules that are responsible for the fine branching of the intratumoral vasculature, allowing the arterioles to branch out and feed into the tumor itself. So it causes premature closure of those capillaries that thereby blocks the delivery of nutrients to the tumor. it is an IV agent.
Interesting. And what was seen, again, qualitatively, subjectively, in terms of side effects and toxicity, in addition to what you mentioned, anything? That was it?
Really just some peripheral edema in a minority of patients.
What about bevacizumab? Can you comment on the new data presented at ASCO, both from the so-called OCEAN study and also the follow-up to ICON 2?
The OCEAN study was different than the GOG-218 data presented or the ICON 7 data presented last year. In the OCEANS trial, women were recruited who had recurrent ovarian cancer in a platinum-sensitive setting. These patients were then treated with carboplatin and gemcitabine with or without the addition of bevacizumab. It was really quite striking in this recurrent setting to see the significant improvement in progression-free interval. Again, a four-month improvement going from 8.4 months in the cohort that got the platinum gemcitabine alone versus 12.4 months in those that had the addition of bevacizumab. And here the hazard ratio is 0.48. Although the overall survival data are not mature, once again, we see a very significant improvement in the progression-free survival in those patients who received the bevacizumab. It really, I think, brings to question not so much the effectiveness of bevacizumab for ovarian cancer, but what is the right time, the right dose, and how long, how much, and who are really the questions that need to be answered.
I guess another one would be whether alone or with chemo.
And I think, again, that is a very important question, and it gets to patient selection as maintenance therapy and when it should be done. And again, the questions of when you stop bevacizumab, what happens to that tumor biology? Do we see rapid tumor regrowth when we stop bevacizumab? And is that part of the reason why in the colon cancer, in the breast cancer, and many of the other tumor sites have been studied longer with this agent, while we see an initial progression-free survival advantage, the overall survival curves really do converge. Indeed, the update of ICON 7 that was presented, again, this is an upfront treatment. It's a phase 3 randomized trial in newly diagnosed ovarian cancer patients getting platinum and paclitaxel with bevacizumab. There was an update presented at the meeting, basically still showing no overall survival advantage. It was different, of course, than the GOG-218 data that was presented in terms of the patients that were entered into that trial. There were some early stage patients who were at high risk. Also, the dose of bevacizumab and the length of the maintenance therapy. As one looks at the body of data surrounding bevacizumab these days, I think we probably can say we shouldn't use it in folks who have early stage disease, that individuals either with suboptimal primary disease seem to see a significant progression-free survival advantage, or those with RECIST measurable recurrent disease. So when you actually have bulky tumor versus perhaps an optimal group, bevacizumab seems to improve the responses. And I think both OCEANS and the analyses done from ICON 7 with those suboptimal patients are really coming around that. What's also been published, of course, with bevacizumab has to do with the costs for year of life saved and the significant increase in costs that are associated, at least with the GOG treatment regimen, which was 15 milligrams per kilogram every 3 weeks and going out into the maintenance phase.
That's for a year.
That was for another year after that. And really cost per year of life save of over $200,000 in the arm, which really exceeds the usual standards that have been accepted. But I am very excited about the potential role of bevacizumab in this recurrent setting.
And how do you use it, if at all, in your practice outside a protocol setting, specifically to use it alone or with chemo? Or do you use it at all?
I do use bevacizumab outside of protocol settings. There continues to be some difficulties with reimbursement, so that needs to be individualized. Ovarian cancer is a very interesting disease biology, of course, with much of a capillary leak type syndrome leading to the ascites and the pleural effusions. And bevacizumab is a very effective agent in controlling the effusions and the ascites. That said, I most frequently use it in combination. And the choice of the chemo agent, which I combine it with, depends on many patient-specific characteristics. Using it with the metronomic low-dose cyclophosphamide as an oral agent, and then the IV every third week bevacizumab is a very well-tolerated, and I've seen great effectiveness with that regimen. And I will say that's the regimen I've found most likely to be reimbursed by insurers.
You mentioned, I think alluded to the issue in terms of ascites and the vascular effects. Every investor I meet with, I always ask about, you know, have you seen any cases where people who had really bad recurrent ascites that the bevacizumab seemed to help?
Yes, I've seen it help many times. Bevacizumab single agent being able to lead to the resolution of ascites. Taxanes themselves also have effect on much of that capillary leak. And often I have combined bevacizumab with even low-dose weekly paclitaxel and seen effectiveness with that, combining it with every other week Doxil at a low dose, and really do see, again, anecdotally, very significant responses, and especially when effusions or ascites are a part of the given clinical picture.
So let's get back to your 42-year-old woman. I'm going to take a wild guess and say she got intraperitoneal therapy, had some moderate problems, but got through it.
She did very well. She got IP therapy. There are only anecdotal data, but presented at SGO 2 years ago, showing that perhaps the dose intensity provided by IP platinum, but using IP therapy in BRCA carriers, actually has even further advantages. And we have a very skilled nursing team and 24/7 outpatient cancer institute that allows us to provide the necessary support to get folks through the IP therapy, and have seen, you know, with the GOG data demonstrating median survivals at 66 months and significant improvements with IP treatments, a young patient like this I thought was an excellent candidate to undergo that type of aggressive treatment.
How specifically did she do? Did she have any? She must have had some problems, I'm sure.
The primary things that we expect, and we really schedule just about all these patients undergoing IP therapy to come in for intravenous hydration. With the longer AUC, because of the pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics of the intraperitoneal administration of drug, many of the side effects, such as nausea, tend to be more protracted. But with the use of the longer acting HT3 antagonists, we're really able to manage the nausea much better. She did not have significant neuropathy, although that is always the other concern. But her blood counts and her ability to tolerate the treatment went quite well. She did have young children at home and was really able to maintain many of her activities of daily living while on the treatment.
What kind of work did she do, and did she continue to work?
This patient did not. She had two school-age sons and was able to be home. She actually, interestingly, never told her sons she had cancer. She was able to come in, drive carpools, do her things she needed to do in her work at home, caring for them and her family, and wearing a wig because of the alopecia, but was able to really maintain her activities of daily living.
What's her current status?
She's free of disease.
Awesome. Let's talk about your 78-year-old woman.
I think we all often see patients who present either through an emergency room or through their primary caregiver who have multiple chronic medical problems. This was a woman who's the mom of a physician who came into the emergency room with new onset of shortness of breath. She has a long history of atrial fibrillation due to valvular disease, histories of CHF, and had had a number of TIAs that she was really pretty functional from, but presented to the emergency room with new onset of shortness of breath, was found to have a large pleural effusion, moderate amount of ascites, but really it was the pleural effusion that the ER docs initially noted, and then did the CT scan demonstrating an omental cake and ascites. She did not have significant pelvic masses. Really, most of her disease was in the upper abdomen. The ovaries were larger than they should have been for a 78-year-old, meaning that they were 3 or 4 centimeters in size. But she didn't have any bowel symptomatology in terms of an impending obstruction, just some discomfort and anorexia from the ascites. She had a thoracentesis in light of her symptomatology, and it revealed high-grade adenocarcinoma consistent with a Mullerian primary, and on the immunohistochemistry did stain very positive for CA125.
How often do you see pleural effusions in ovarian cancer?
Stage 4 disease is often due to pleural effusions, and that makes up about 10 or 15% of all of the stage distribution of ovarian cancer. In the high-risk group, again, we don't even tap them all often. And I think the big difference there, Neil, is whether you want to say symptomatic pleural effusions or any pleural effusion. You know, I think 15% having small pleural effusions is not uncommon. Symptomatic pleural effusions are at least half of that, maybe 5 to 7% present with symptomatic pleural effusions.
So this sounds like a pretty challenging situation. How did you think it through?
Again, as a gynecologic oncologist who really believes in the role of primary cytoreductive surgery and knows our inability to predict that from CT alone, it is a consideration that always runs through my mind. However, with the very compelling data that have been presented from the EORTC and presented by Vergote in the last year and published in the New England Journal of Medicine, really brings us again to question the role of primary chemotherapy versus primary surgery or neoadjuvant chemotherapy. In that trial, again, not done in the U.S., patients were randomized to either undergo primary chemotherapy or primary surgery. And really, the punchline was that there was no difference in overall survival whether or not the patients had neoadjuvant chemotherapy or primary surgery. I think it brings to question the patient selection. The Europeans tend not to have as high a rate of optimal cytoreduction. Indeed, in that trial, only about 40% of the individuals undergoing primary surgery had disease cytoreduced down to less than 1 centimeter. So that may have played into that. But indeed, as one looks at this very well-done phase 3 randomized controlled trial, there was no difference in overall survival between neoadjuvant chemotherapy and primary surgery.
Maybe I'm a little naive in looking at this, but why would you be thinking about surgery if she has a pleural effusion, you know, with positive cells?
There are a number of studies looking at stage 4 ovarian cancer, specifically with those women with pleural effusion alone, demonstrating the significant improvement in survival if one can have optimal cytoreduction of all the gross disease in the abdomen. So if my 42-year-old patient, who we discussed a moment ago, had had a pleural effusion, I still would have proceeded with the cytoreductive surgery based on data that demonstrates she too would have had the survival benefit from having all those potentially resistant clones of tumor removed. Again, the rationale for surgery in ovary cancer has to do with its exquisite chemosensitivity and the late stage at detection, so that there are many clones. It's a polyclonal disease at diagnosis at stage 3 and 4. And we know there will be inherent tumor-resistant clones. So by doing the surgery, you improve tumor vasculature, you increase the growth fraction, you remove those chemo-resistant clones from the get-go to allow the further treatment at a later time. So it still is something that should be considered. However, one needs to also think of the morbidity of the procedure. And clearly in the Vergote trial, there was less morbidity from the surgery that was done after the neoadjuvant chemotherapy. There was less time in the operating room and less surgical complications in those who had neoadjuvant chemotherapy. In fact, in the neoadjuvant chemotherapy arm, when the patients ultimately did go to surgery, which was part of the trial, about 80% of them had an optimal status. And as I say, the overall survival in those two arms did overlap. So in this 78-year-old who was on Coumadin, who was on Plavix, who had AFib, a history of CHF, previous TIAs, and now with a massive pleural effusion.
I can't wait to hear this one.
I know. And no compelling reason to take it to the OR. I mean, sometimes we get in a real tough bind because they have an impending bowel obstruction and you have to operate on them. We had a cytologic diagnosis of cancer consistent with a high-grade Mullerian carcinoma with the high CA125 as well. So I did give her neoadjuvant intravenous chemotherapy. I gave her the carbo at an AUC of 5, slightly lower than I have in other cases, and the paclitaxel. Although I will say in some of these cases, this patient, despite those medical problems, actually was quite functional. But in some of these cases, we even need to do single-agent carboplatin, which is very effective in drying up the effusions, which is what it did. She's still on treatment, but has had just about complete resolution of the effusions. She still has some ascites that's seen on scan, but she is functionally back to her usual state.
Wow. I didn't expect that.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What do you see in terms of future treatment for this? Like, of course, everybody picks cases that do well, but that's understandable. You want to, you know, kind of create a model out there. But what do you see in this woman's future?
She will hopefully have the opportunity to die from something other than ovarian cancer. But I think the real question is going to be, how long do you treat her for and what are your real endpoints? She's responded. She's completed 6 cycles of treatment. And the question now is, do you just follow her? Sometimes we'll do a laparoscopy, remove the ovaries. I don't think this patient is going to gain any benefit from going to the OR. She still has ascites. The tumor hasn't completely melted away. She's just no longer symptomatic. So the question is really with her and her family, do you try to get her through a much less aggressive procedure? You could probably do a minimally invasive procedure at this time, and she's had a good enough response that either robotically or laparoscopically, one could at least remove the ovaries and omentum. And the rationale for doing that is that's most likely where she will have the tumor grow back, since that's where it was before, and the bed is not sterilized. And that may decrease her risk for future ascites and all. So those are the conversations that we're entertaining now with the family and with the patient with regards to some type of minimally invasive approach to try to extend her time that she can have and not require chemotherapy.